The Theosophical Society presents N. Sri Ram in a talk entitled Spiritual Intuition.
Consciousness in its pure state is like Akasha or ether, pregnant with life. It is not just matter. We may think of it as a kind of substance that extends all over space, but it is living. But it is also like light, which reveals what otherwise would be enveloped in darkness. There are so many things around us, but for the fact there is light, we would not be aware of their presence or existence. So consciousness is like light. If I were not conscious, there might be so many things around me, but I wouldn't know that they exist. So to compare consciousness to light, which makes the existence of things manifest or evident, seems to me to be an appropriate comparison. HPB says somewhere, probably in the last volume of The Secret Doctrine, light above and life below. That is to say, light is consciousness, and life, as I pointed out this morning, is of the very essence of consciousness. So when we use the words light and life, we see that they are very closely connected. So this consciousness, which reveals whatever exists, may well be described as a mirror of truth. It just presents the mirror to existence, whatever exists, whatever takes place. Not only exists to one's outer vision, but whatever exists, the thoughts exist, feelings exist, all kinds of movements in one consciousness take place. It is a mirror which can reflect the whole of this. It reflects things in the world of matter, not only things in the ordinary sense, chair, table, tree, the bodies and so on, but also their subjective truth or content. That is perhaps requires a certain annotation. The subjective truth is the truth of the being of the thing, which can only be perceived by us subjectively inside ourselves. If you are sufficiently sensitive, you will perceive that truth. Otherwise, it cannot be perceived. That is the subjective truth. Now, as I said this morning, there is hovering, as it were, over the evolution of each thing in nature, a divine idea, which that thing, in the present stage of evolution, represents most imperfectly. The evolutionary process is a movement towards a greater perfection. That is obvious. But as I said this morning, one might imagine the divine idea as present invisibly, presiding over the whole evolutionary process, so that the thing takes one step forward and evolves into something better and superior. This is the whole evolutionary process. Now, this divine idea, you may think of it as hovering over that process, or you might think of it as embodied within that thing. If you have the eyes to see, you will see. In me, there is already present to the eye that can perceive what I shall be. That is to say, the figure of beauty is already concealed in the block of marble. So when all the excrescent marble, the superfluous marble, the superincumbent material is removed, that figure will be made manifest. So in the same way, in each thing, in a tree, in a bird, in an animal, in you, in me, there is present, as it were, this divine perfection which can be perceived only by the eye that can perceive it. But it is still there. The eye of the spirit, let us call it. In Voice of the Silence, H.P.B. uses the phrase the eye of Shiva. Shiva is one of the Trinity in the Hindu pantheon. The eye of Shiva. She also uses the Tibetan word with which I am not acquainted, the eye of Dangma. This is incidentally because there is some reference to it. It is that eye to which nothing is closed, from which there radiates a certain light to which nothing is opaque. It can penetrate and reveal everything. That is the spiritual vision, as one might say. Well, this divine idea in each thing, in other words, the archetype that is concealed in the nature of the thing, you may call it the subjective truth. In other words, there is a certain beauty in each thing which may not be apparent, but which may perhaps be sensed vaguely. It may be felt. And when a person falls in love with somebody, he sees something of this beauty. But when you say the subjective content, that may be certain feelings, certain ideas. It may not be the purely spiritual thing to which we use the word truth, but it may be some psychic movement, let us say. Some move, some emotion, some instinct, the working of some desire. All these things are present in each thing that exists until it is completely transformed and becomes purely spiritual. And it is then, this consciousness is then purely, when it is pure, it is spiritual. That is, there is no distinction to be made between this pure consciousness and a spiritual consciousness. So I don't think it would be a correct idea to think first we become pure, then we become spiritual. I don't think the spirituality is something which exists somewhere outside with which we are going to charge ourselves when we become pure. That, I think, is a false idea. When the consciousness is pure, untainted by matter, matter, of course, cannot taint consciousness, but it can taint it through sensation. It is through sensation that we perceive all kinds of matter. Here is a piece of wood. I touch it. I understand its nature to some extent. But it is really a sensation by means of which I identify this piece of wood as wood of a certain type. So all things in the world of matter are perceived by the consciousness only in the form of sensations. So the pure consciousness cannot be tainted by matter. Sensation doesn't taint. It's only a form of cognition. when there is attachment to the sensation, then out of that attachment there arises desire, various complications in that consciousness, which constitutes the hindrance, the taint, the trouble, the complex, whatever it may be. Now, when it is in this absolutely pure condition, untainted, then it branches out, as it were, from the spiritual root in the individual, because we are referring to the consciousness of an individual. From that spiritual root, which is the root of true individuality in the person, it branches out into a world of truth and beauty. You know, it cognizes truth and beauty, but I am using the word branching out in order to indicate that all these movements make a coherent whole. It is not just wandering in that world from one truth to another or one beautiful thing to another. It's not a stranger to that realm. It opens out into that world like a marvelous celestial lotus, let us say. Freed from the thraldom of matter, it gravitates to the spirit. It naturally gravitates. When there is this freedom, it is there. Or, instead of using the word gravitate to, you might say, it settles around the spirit, it forms around the spirit. All these are various ways of saying things. But you must go a little bit behind the phrase or the word to the reality. That is to say, we have to do something to push it into the arms of the spirit, so to say. We cannot push it. When we say we, what do we mean by we? It is this mind which is thinking, which says we. And how can this mind push the consciousness, the pure nature of which it perhaps does not understand, to spirit, which is something quite unknown to it? It's all absurd, the whole thing. The consciousness, which becomes, as it were, the body of the spirit, or rather, I should say, the body of the spiritual center, has a different nature from what we find now. It acts entirely differently. It expresses different things. That is what we said in other terms by saying different meanings. What does meaning mean? The meaning of a thing is what you understand in your consciousness, is it not? There is no other meaning. Meaning is what you perceive, what you understand, what is of some significance to your inner understanding or feeling. That is meaning. So, this pure consciousness, which, as it were, becomes the medium of the spirit, it becomes the vessel of the spirit, channel of the spirit, medium of the spirit. You can use whatever words you like, provided, of course, they are appropriate. Well, it has a different nature. It acts differently. It expresses different things. I'm coming to what we call intuition. Now, if you think of the mind as we know it, as it is in you and in me, we see that this mind is really adapted to deal with matter, the world of matter, the differences which exist there. This mind takes note of particular things. It says this is long, that is short, this is green, that is yellow, perceives all the differences. But how does it perceive? It goes to one thing after another. First I notice you, then I notice something else, something else. It is in this way, it moves towards particulars. And then it understands the relations between them. It is adapted to deal with the world of matter. It is manas, of course. The mind, which is the medium of the spirit, is buddhi. That the mind which is adapted to deal with material conditions and differences is manas. But the mind of the spirit, we might say, is buddhi. It is usually translated as the spiritual intuition. But you know, you intuit something. The intuition is the result of a certain action which takes place. What is that action? You can't perceive the action. It takes place, as it were, behind a veil. The intuition merely flashes into your consciousness. Yes, I see, yes. So you come to some law, or you conceive something very beautiful, or you experience some pure feeling. All this will come under the category of intuition. But how this intuition arose, what process there was, of which this intuition is the outcome, it is really not possible for us to say. And of course, when I used the word spirit, I said the mind, which is the medium of spirit, instrument of spirit, is buddhi. Well, I am here using the word spirit as a blanket term. You know, a blanket term is a term which covers a great deal. It is a summation of an infinity of motions and creation. There are various ways in which the consciousness can move. There are various ways, forms of creation, ways in which it can create. That word spirit sums up this whole thing. All harmonious. That is to say, the motion that takes place in the field of consciousness should express a harmony. And whatever is created in the field of consciousness must also embody harmony. And this action should take place without diminishing the freedom of the consciousness. It must not in any way be agitated. You mustn't do anything to it which will prevent free action in that field of consciousness. If there are such movements, such creation, all that is included in this blanket term of spirit. Anyhow, that is my way of understanding it, or perhaps it is one way of understanding it. Now, manas and buddhi are in Indian philosophy regarded as two distinct principles in the constitution of man, two distinct aspects of consciousness, two distinct modes of motion, modes of function. Always you find that in all the old books, you find they speak of manas, they speak of buddhi. Of course, people translate and understand buddhi in various ways. You may not always find in those books the explanation that I am putting before you. They may not explain it in that way. They may use other terms. It is manas which thinks. Well, what is the process of thinking? Of course, each one can know for himself, because he is all the time thinking. We reason from one thing to another, logically, reason step by step. However quickly you may reason, you may have a mind which is swift, which is very clever, a practiced mind, but nevertheless, reasoning is always step by step. The mind, therefore, has to take a series of steps to come to a conclusion. And it always labors to come to the conclusion, to arrive at the truth. What actually happens is this. There are various facts which are present in my mind. These facts are either ideas or images of things which I have contacted. All this is in my memory. What I do is I pick up some of these things and then I shift these facts. You know, suppose you have a number of counters on the table, on a car table, let us say, even service, you can shift them about. That is what it does. Just as a person who is working on a mathematical equation sometimes puts certain terms together. He transfers one term to this side. He shifts the terms or the pieces of the equation and rearranges them, puts them in a different order, and sees whether it is all right. And that is really the process of thinking. We might not have observed it in detail, but if you try to observe it, you will find that it is taking hold of a number of facts in the mind, that is, number of images, number of impressions, ideas, and then perceiving the relations between them and shifting them about, putting them in a different order to see whether it makes some sense. So that is the kind of thinking which takes place. But at the same time, as I pointed out the other day, there is the construction of images. Can you think without forming images? You cannot. Any word which is uttered immediately produces some image, some figure, some notation, let me say, if nothing else. So it constructs these images out of material already gathered. The material is there, it is in my memory. All the impressions, all the things, everything is there. Out of this material, the image is constructed from moment to moment. This whole thing takes place very quickly, so perhaps we do not really been able to follow this thinking process. This material is memory, the material which is used to construct an image. Can you think something which you think of something which you have never contacted before? You cannot do it. You can think of something which is novel, which is a little bit like what you have previously experienced or contacted. That you can do. Or you can put two or three things already in your mind together and produce something novel. But you cannot imagine a fragrance which is completely unlike any fragrance that you have ever experienced. Unlike any smell, any fragrance. Can you think of something absolutely new? Not something new, you know, as the perfumist makes. It's all kind of synthetic. He mixes things together, puts a little bit of this and a little bit of that. He makes a compound, a mixture which will differ a little bit. I don't mean that. Something absolutely new, you cannot. Very often, our thinking is only the mechanical action of these memories. You sit there, you go on thinking as you think. It is just the memories which are working all the time. That is the nature of the mind. You have to understand it in order to realize how intuition can work or buddhi can work. And the mind knows things only from a distance. And it knows only the form of things. What it thinks it knows about life is by inference and comparison. You observe the movements of a living thing. And then you attribute certain motives or feelings to that thing. Why do you attribute those motives or feelings to that thing? Because when those movements take place, you know from your own experience what is the kind of feeling or motive which will produce that action. So there is comparison with yourself and there is inference. So what the mind knows about the nature of life in any living thing is merely by observation from a distance, by comparison with one's own experience, and by inference. It doesn't know for certain. It doesn't know. Suppose you look at a thing. How do you know the truth of the thing? You know it only by vibrations which come to you. And these vibrations are in some extraordinary manner. Vibrations are like code signals, you know. The telegraph is signals. They are like that, just impulses. But in some miraculous manner, they are translated into sensations somewhere in our consciousness. Now, are the vibrations real or is the sensation real? Which is real? Of course, from the scientist's point of view, the vibrations are real. The sensations may be subjective. You may imagine this sensation or feel this sensation when there is really no cause, as the scientist thinks. So, but actually to us it is the sensation which is real. That is what we actually experience in the very substance or the body of consciousness. And then, so you see, the mind always understands everything from a distance by interpretation. And then it has to hypothesize, produce a hypothesis. It has to suppose. It has to theorize. The scientist knows all this. He's all the time working out theories. He supposes this and then he dismisses the supposition. For a long time, modern science rode on the back of ether, as one might say. Later it found that the ether was not necessary and ether was dismissed. Now science is able to work out its equations, achieve whatever it wants to achieve without this ether, which is like God, entirely superfluous. That is to say, from the scientific point of view, for the equations of science to produce the atomic bomb and to detonate it, ether is not necessary. So you see, when you hypothesize, you are not moving on the ground of facts. You are moving over it. As I said the other day, you are putting a bridge, as it were, between one fact and another in order to connect this with the other. That is a hypothesis. This relativity equation and all that is really a kind of building a bridge. Something happens here, something happens there. You don't perceive the connection of it. But you take all the data with regard to it and you have your equation, then you get all the data with regard to that. So the two things are connected up by this equation. So the equation is not something tangible which you can observe, but it is an abstraction, it is a kind of bridge which is built, which connects different facts. If we were omniscient, if we could see into the nature of things, we will then would need no hypothesis, no theory, because we see all the inner connections, all the threads, everything is there before you. So we won't need to speculate and theorize and hypothesize and suppose and invent and dismiss and do all that kind of thing. No, further, the whole action of the mind is partial. That is to say, there is a field of facts. There are a number of things to be noted. And you have to take all that into consideration. But you begin with one fact and you gradually link up the other facts with it, one by one. So as you proceed from this corner of the field and cover a certain area and then cover a further area, you know, your whole perspective is a partial perspective because you don't cover the whole thing at the same time. If you look at this whole tent from that corner, you get a certain perspective. But it is only a partial perspective. If you stand somewhere else and look at it, it will be a different perspective. If you can sort of hang above the heads of the people, float above them, and see, then again you get a different perspective altogether. So the mind always moves partially. First of all, its data may not be complete. It begins here and it infers certain things. But apart from that, its whole outlook is partial. And the experience of its movement as it moves along, that experience is also partial. In other words, all this I can sum up in one sentence, but it would require a great deal of explanation. It moves towards truth. The mind does not know the truth. It moves towards truth. Now, buddhi is entirely different. I had to speak about the mind because how can you speak of spiritual intuition except to the intuition of the other person? You have to explain things in a way which the mind can understand. So you have to speak of the action of intuition in terms of the mind. You see the difficulty in understanding the nature of intuition. You have to explain it in terms of the mind. And the mind, of course, has its own way of acting. So it has to construct some kind of a picture and then imagine this is how the intuition acts. Unless, of course, a person has experienced it in himself, even if it be only at certain moments, he will know what the nature of intuition is. Now, buddhi is the action of the whole consciousness, the whole of it. Now, I have to resort to a simile, which will perhaps explain to you. But, all similes must not be stretched too far. They are merely aids to understanding. Analogy is not a proof. It merely illustrates. This is like that, therefore you try to understand it. That is all. But it is not a proof. Suppose you imagine a consciousness as a sphere, a globe, and a translucent sphere, so that there is no opaqueness. It is a perfect sphere. In fact, the sphere is spoken of as the perfect solid. And so it is usually like the circle. The sphere is also regarded as a symbol of perfection or eternity. But anyhow, that's beside the point. You imagine a kind of translucent sphere, and what is the material of which the surface is made? It is consciousness itself. The whole surface of it, at every point, it is just conscious. Not conscious of something, but the essence of consciousness, the capability of consciousness, the essence of consciousness. Now, you have the sphere before you. Suppose you imagine a motion from every point of the surface towards the center. Towards, not right up to the center, but there is a movement from every side, from every point in that sphere towards the center up to a certain point, and the result of it is a figure of perfect beauty, marvelous beauty. Suppose the figure is created by this motion as though each point is a kind of individual who moves towards the center, and they all together stand in a formation round the center, and this formation is perfection itself. It is something marvelously beautiful. Now, of course, this is just a simile, as I have told you, but to illustrate how there can be action from all sides of the sphere, the whole being of man, the whole of his consciousness, but all this, as it were, move towards the center, and there is created by this joint movement taking place from every side, every sector, every point, a figure of absolute perfection. Now this form, or just the beauty of it, or it may not be beauty in form, it may be just a feeling which, as it were, pervades the whole form, is the very soul of that form, is the very essence of that form, and the whole form exists merely to convey this feeling. It may be such a feeling, it may be such a form, that is a creation of the whole consciousness, the whole of it, by this movement. It is created with an electric swiftness, not saying, now you stand here, don't stand there, and so on, not that kind of thing. It's an electric swiftness with which this action takes place. And what is created, this perfect figure, is not an assemblage, taking different parts, putting them together, as you construct a house or as you construct a machine. It is not an assemblage, but it is the instantaneous creation of an artist. You must imagine that there is an intelligence there pervading this whole sphere of consciousness, which has the nature of a master artist, and at the same time this intelligence is electronic in its action, and in one instant, by one movement from every side, it creates right in the center of consciousness that perfect figure, that beauty, that feeling, whatever it may be, which is created. I don't know how else to express the action of buddhi. I remember an article which Brother Jinarajadasa wrote many years ago. Of course, the article was entitled, "Are We Not Artists All?" You know, there are some people who are spoken of as artists. Some of them think that they belong to an exclusive species. Some of them, they are all foolish. Everyone belongs to an exclusive club, an exclusive category in his own opinion, on account of something or other, whatever it may be. There is always something which makes you different from others and of which you can be proud. So if you want to be proud, something can always be found which other people do not have. But he said, in every one of us, there is the artist. There is the element of the artist, the germ of the artist. There is the potentiality of the artist. I don't remember the article. He didn't explain it as I did, but he did it in his own way. So, there is this intelligence. It has an extraordinary artistic quality, and it can create instantly, and the creation is perfect. And what is created, let me say once again, needn't necessarily be a form. It may be just a feeling. It may be just a beauty which is not form, which is not sound, which is not color. It can be that. You know, Minerva, who was the goddess of wisdom, is said to have arisen fully formed and perfect out of the head of Jupiter. She just arose out of his head, and she was there perfect. That is the creation of buddhi every time. Now, is there this possibility in nature, or is it just kind of romancing? Are we merely dreaming dreams, thinking that all this happens? Are we doing that, or is there such a possibility? There will be such a possibility if in the whole of one's consciousness there is a kind of electric character. Electric means extremely sensitive, that kind of character. And in the whole sphere, there is nothing to block the movement. In our own consciousness, What is it which blocks movement? A feeling of frustration, that is a blockage. Tension, that is a blockage. Crisscross forces, likes and dislikes. I like, I don't like, prejudice, predilection. These are agitation, whirlpools. When nothing of this is present there, then the whole inside of the sphere is absolutely open. There can be free movement from every point. In other words, the consciousness has not been structured. It has not been erected into a structure as it is in the case of all of us. You know, it assumes a certain structure. How does it assume? I have definite ideas on various matters, political, social, individual, religious, private, personal. On all these matters, I have definite ideas. So all these ideas are present in that structure. And then I have various habitual ways of thinking and behavior and feeling and all that. So all that give a certain definiteness, a particular character to my mind, which can be spoken of as a structure. The mind gets structured, set up in a particular way. But there cannot be this movement of the whole when the mind is structured, but only when there is complete openness, there is freedom of movement, and the whole consciousness is just fluid. It's like water. Water without any substance that diminishes its clarity, its purity. Or, I might use this word, when there is no viscosity in the substance of the consciousness. You know, viscous, it's sticking. Not like honey, but like clear mountain stream, that kind of consciousness. But if there is some lump in the consciousness, some idea which sticks in the throat, which you can't get it out, so to say, if there is some coagulation which has taken place, you know, all these are similes borrowed from our experience of things material. But how can you speak of it except in terms of simile? You cannot speak of it in any other way. So we have to use all these words, substance, coagulation, clotting, viscosity and anything else that you may be able to think of. Now, all these phenomena are caused by attachment. That explains all the phenomena. Attached to this, attached to that, attached to a third thing, and 1,001 things. And also from fear, which always arises from attachment. If there is no attachment, there will be no fear. I will not try to explain this further. At least I believe that there will be no fear. So until that state is attained, that translucency, that openness, that freedom, that purity, that fluidity, until that is attained, intuition can only be occasional. At a favorable moment, when you are relaxed, when the mind is not preoccupied, then at such a moment, thank God we do have such moments, there can be an intuition. People do have intuition. And it is not a product of mechanical action. When there is mechanical action in the mind, there is always a degree of unawareness. Mechanism means automatism. And when something takes place automatically, you will tend to be unaware of it. So the very awareness of our automatic actions and thinking will release intelligence. The moment you are aware, yes, I am doing this mechanically, automatically, the very perception of this automatism is bringing the intelligence to bear on the whole situation. As I said, I believe this morning or yesterday, all that I have said is rather a glorious mixture in my mind at present. Well, there is in our own body, in the processes which take place there, an electronic intelligence which coordinates in a miraculous manner. Everything is, at every point of the body, there is a coordination of processes. Without it, there is no health. There is no well-being. The machine will work with much friction. Now, this intelligence is instinctive, just by instinct. But still, it's a kind of intelligence. Now, the intelligence of Buddhi produces not mere coordination of different things, but harmony, which has a far superior significance. A number of things are coordinated. They are timed, synchronized, made to fit in with one another. That is coordination. That has a certain significance. But when you say harmony, you think of the harmony in music. It has an altogether superior significance. And the intelligence of Buddhi doesn't merely has this sense of harmony. I'll put it this way. It has this sense of harmony. It acts electronically, with electronic swiftness, but at the same time, as I said, it's the master artist, so it knows instinctively just what is beautiful. And this harmony, this figure of beauty, it can be a perfect synthesis. It can be a synthesis, it can be a judgment, because a judgment, a synthesis, is composed of different elements, but integrated. They are made into a whole. Now, the mind is not like that. The mind, as I said a little while ago, is directed towards particulars. It is that type of consciousness. So it goes to this, it goes to that. It doesn't know how to evaluate, so it balances considerations. Shall I do this? This will be to my advantage. If I do that, perhaps that is better. The whole time it is oscillating with conflicting thoughts. You know, when there is a personal problem, you know how much confusion there is. Shall I do this? Shall I do that? You are the whole time weighing this and weighing that. You know, you can't evaluate precisely and at once. So you just, it is confused. The mind is unsure. That is the characteristic of the mind as we find it. It can be different, but it has to be transformed. But Buddhi is sure. It has an instinctive sense of harmony, of beauty. And this sense is something which cannot be thought out. Can you think out a sense of harmony or beauty? You cannot. You can work out various things, ratios, proportions, and all that, but you cannot really produce music merely by working out ratios and proportions in the frequencies and vibrations. And the mind is impelled by subconscious forces, this way and that, whereas Buddhi is not under any such impulsion. Therefore, it experiences a certain spontaneity, a freedom of movement. And it arrives at the conclusion, the truth, immediately. Perhaps I should not say conclusion, and I should not use the word arrive. It may be that there is no arrival. It is just there on the spot where the truth is. So intuition is not a hunch. It is really a faculty. Very often we think intuition. It's wishful thinking. I have an intuition that he will arrive today. You want him to arrive. It's a subconscious wish. You are hoping for it. And the hope and the wish and all that, the expectation, produces this thought he will arrive. And then you say, I have an intuition he will arrive. You say, I feel he may arrive if you like. I have no objection. But provided you understand that it is not a hunch. It's a fact, but it is like instinct. But there is much difference between instinct and intuition. The instinct is always fixed. It is repetitive. It will work in the same way. It works mechanically. It will work only in certain situations. It is blind. Its action is elemental, as you might say. I might explain here what I mean by elemental. You know, blindly, you can find the way of least resistance, can you not? You grope and you find this is the way where there is the least impediment. Suppose the ground is sloping and there is not one slope but several slopes. You try to find out which is the slope which is best. And water will flow along the slope. That is elemental. It's a kind of blind action which takes place in quite a mechanical way. But buddhi is not that. It is always pliable. It is not fixed. It is not repetitive. It is original. It is not limited. It is free. It is not mechanical. It is not elemental, but it is intelligent. So it works like an instinct, but it has other characteristics. But the growth of the mind has suppressed instinct, because by its confusions and contradictions, you find everywhere in nature there is instinct. It is marvelous. Some of the primitive people, the Aborigines as they are called in Australia, have an extraordinary instinct for detecting water at a distance of 100 or 200 miles. They live on the desert. They need to find a pool. The pool may exist about 150 miles away. If you are there in the desert, it is like a trackless ocean. You do not know in which direction to turn. But somehow they know it is just there. They will go there. And birds fly 4,000 miles. Fishes also swim 4,000 miles against currents, against innumerable obstacles, just to the spot where they were last year. It is extraordinary. There are such instincts. But how is it that the animal kingdom has this instinct? We are supposed to have evolved further. We regard ourselves as superior beings. We don't possess that instinct. We have lost it. Why? Because we have developed this mind which is always confused, unsure, divided between this and that, laboring, making calculations, making mistakes, rubbing all the figures and then starting over again. You know, this kind of thing, which I sometimes do when I make additions of figures. Well, the growth of the mind has suppressed the instinct by confusing it, by the contradictory movements. Now the question is, if animals and birds can move by an absolutely sure instinct, there is that possibility in nature. And there must be that possibility in man. Even though he is unable to act in that way, there must be that possibility. Can we have a mind that acts differently and preserves the sureness and the instinctive action of the earlier stage? Can we not have that kind of instinct which works absolutely surely while retaining the use of the mind? I think it should be possible. So when the mind is free in itself from its own tethers, its self-created obstacles and fetters, then this mind, or manas rather, that pure state, perhaps manas might be the better word, automatically integrates itself with buddhi. Of course, with spirit, as I said. I said, buddhi is the mind of the spirit. It integrates itself through buddhi. Then it is buddhi manas. Buddhi hyphen manas, which HPB speaks of. It becomes integrated. It is just one. And then it's capable of intuiting the truth. It's capable of creating from moment to moment. And every creation will be creation of beauty. It becomes a mind which is poetical and truthful at the same time. Not fanciful, given to fantasy, daydreaming. Not that. But poetical, perceiving beauty, having that sense of beauty, but able to act so swiftly, as I have pointed out. So such a consciousness, buddhi manas, or whatever name you give to it, it is both poetical and it is true. There is all this theosophical realism and every kind of realism in that mind. It doesn't depart from the real. It creates according to its honoring instinct, which you might call genius. And such a mind, in all its creations, embodies a quality which is absolute, which is timeless.